Previously on Beta.
Well, good luck, Ron, with your new redneck friend.
I'll have to let you all get on the rest of the night without the aid of my marvelous wit. The whole ordeal has made me quite a bit exhausted.
You only get to make that mistake one time, you dig?
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Tanana Reeve Dew joins us to talk about her novel, The Between, and how she defines black horror.
There must have been, I think, something about the state of being in alternate realities that spoke to a black American experience in my mind.
Also, Ian Haydn Smith is back with another installment of Cult Filmmakers. This time, it's a double bill as he discusses the work of Melvin Van Peebles and Gordon Parks.
And Gordon Parks' photos, he never loses a sense of humanity. There's a formal beauty to his work. And he really is a truly extraordinary photographer.
But first...
So let me ask you this. Would you switch places with me? Do I get the truck? Because if I get the truck, hell yeah, I'll switch places with you, Buddy Lee said. He let out a little chuckle. Oh, you get the truck. But you also get pulled over 4 or 5 times a month because ain't no way your black ass can afford a nice truck like this, right? You get the truck, but you get followed around in the jewelry store because you know you're probably fitting to rob the place, right? You can get the truck, but you got to deal with white ladies clutching their purses when you walk down the street because Fox News done told them you're coming to steal their money and their virtue. Oh, you get the truck, but then you got to explain to some trigger-happy cop that no, Mr. Officer, you're not resisting arrest. You get the truck, but then you also get 2 in the back of the head because you reach for your cell phone, Ike said. He glanced at Buddy Lee. So you still want to trade places? Buddy Lee swallowed hard and turned his head toward the window, but he didn't say a word.
That's novelist Sean Cosby reading an excerpt from his novel, Razorblade Tears. It's the story of a black father, Ike, and a white father, Buddy Lee. They're ex-cons grieving the losses of their gay sons, who were married to each other. After their sons are brutally murdered, Ike and Buddy Lee reluctantly team up to solve the crime. Razorblade Tears is a carefully crafted, fast-paced story of revenge and redemption. Walter Mosley is one of America's greatest crime fiction writers. He says that Sean reinvents the American crime novel. So I gotta ask Sean, does he agree?
No, not at all. And I'm incredibly humbled and moved by Walter saying that, you know, in my estimation, he reinvented the great American crime novel when he created E.Z. Rawlins.
Maybe you reinvented it, though.
I mean, I think there's a part of me that a very small part of me that is egotistical that would love to take credit for that. I think the only thing I did was I wrote about and I continue to write about people that are in some ways invisible in the modern zeitgeist, so to speak, the rural black community. I think there's a lot of people that don't understand or are aware of what that means and what that entails of the modern rural black experience living in the South or the Midwest. And so if anything, I think I kind of tried to shine a light on that. But as far as reinventing the great American crime novel, I am far too much of a Southern Baptist to take that title.
but you have taken a kind of a different path with your novels in terms of, as you mentioned, writing about everyday men who often are ex-cons and they have flaws and they're often trying to redeem themselves. And also your novels are set in the South, which is unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there is this idea, especially among literary circles, that the South is the sole providence of neo-Confederate apologists, and nothing can be further from the truth. You know, I like to say that every scrap of land that a good old boy is waving a Confederate flag walks upon, somebody who looks like me bled, died, and fought for that land. And so they don't get to define what the South is, what the New South or the Old South is. And so I think there aren't a lot of African-American writers who are tackling that because I think it can be a difficult proposition to talk about the South, either in the past or in the modern day. It's hard. It hurts. It's painful. You know, I live in a small town where about 100 feet from the courthouse, The building that you go to, you know, achieve a redress of grievances, there's a huge statue dedicated to Confederate soldiers, you know, and I know what kind of message that's trying to send. And so I think for some folks, it can be difficult. I think am hard-headed enough that I feel like there are stories and there are tales that need to be told here that I think can only be told here. And so that's what I try to do in my work.
Yeah, and I think that's what you're doing very successfully. Can you tell us a bit about your two protagonists in Razorblade Tears, Ike Randolph and Buddy Lee Jenkins?
Yeah, certainly. So Ike and Buddy Lee are men of a certain age, maybe about 5 years older than me. I'll be 50 in 2 years, which is sounds just saying that sounds insane. But these are two men who have lived hard lives. These are men who have lived hard lives and have made mistakes, both personal and public. And they're both ex-cons, but they also are incredibly different. You know, Ike is an African-American man who has achieved a sliver of the American middle-class dream. He owns his own business. He owns his own home, which is very important. I don't think people realize how important it is to own your own house. And he's trying to live the straight and narrow life, whereas Buddy Lee is a white Southerner who is a functioning alcoholic, who, as the book opens, has just lost his latest job. And he's someone who is struggling despite the fact that he has certain privileges that Ike doesn't. And I think for Buddy Lee, it's hard for him to sometimes discern that privilege does not mean success. And those are two different things. You can have privilege and still be unsuccessful. And so what brings them together, unfortunately, is the death of their respective sons who were in a relationship and were married. And so these two sons are killed at the beginning of the book. And both Ike and Buddy Lee were not accepting of their son's identity and who they were as gay men. And so in an effort to get justice for their sons, when it seems like the wheels of the justice system are turning slowly, these two men of violence resort to what they know best to get revenge for their sons, but also I think achieve a bit of redemption for the way they treated those boys and trying to do better by them in death than they did in life.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. They're both very multidimensional characters. How were you able to create such complicated characters?
I knew and continue to know men like Ike and Buddy Lee. I grew up around men who are in some ways trapped by a antiquated idea of masculinity and what it means to be a man and what it means to be quote unquote tough and whatever that looks like. And I think these men that I grew up around who aren't bad men, if you ask them, you know, they aren't men that would kick a dog or be cruel to a baby, but they're also men that are very narrow-minded in their ideas and their beliefs. And so I think for me growing up, I had to learn to respect those men for what they brought to my life as a young boy, but also learn to disseminate a different type of viewpoint. Because what I learned is that, you know, my personal definition of masculinity does not have to correlate with yours or anybody else's. And someone else's definition of masculinity doesn't diminish mine. And so these characters are portraits of people that I grew up around, people in my family, the fathers and brothers and sons of people that I knew. And so I tried to tell and create their stories and be as honest as I could, you know, which entails showing some of the ugly parts of their personalities.
You've come up with this great description of what you call the Holy Trinity of Southern fiction. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, I've always loved reading, and I'm a voracious reader even to this day. And I feel like Southern fiction has a very specific distinction that it's this foundation, its Holy Trinity, of, if you will, is race, sex, and class. And you could throw religion in that class definition, because religion definitely is a part of that class discussion. But those are the things that define the South in a different way than any other region in America. There is class struggle in the Northeast. There's class struggle in the Midwest. But I don't believe there is that super close proximity to the blood and the horror of, you know, 400 years of slavery that exists in the South. Like I said, I live in a small town that is, you know, has a lot of black citizens, but there's a Confederate flag every 50 feet. There's Confederate statues. You know, I went to elementary school at a school that was named after Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. And so there is this sense in the South that these ghosts that haunt us, we got to confront them daily, whether we want to or not. And so those ghosts are the hauntings, the phantoms of race and class and sex. And I think in Raised by Tears, I tried to talk about all three of them in a hopefully interesting way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think you did that. How did you go about weaving this holy trinity of race, class, and sex into Raised by Tears?
I wanted to show characters like Buddy Lee and Ike at different stations on the social hierarchy, but at the same time still show that all things being equal, Buddy Lee is probably going to fare better in an interaction with the police or an interaction with a white shop owner than Ike would, even though Ike is the financially and sociologically more successful of the two. And so that's talking about the class distinction, because class distinction in the South is very apparent. The Civil War was fought by poor whites trying to defend the right of rich whites to own people. And so I wanted to definitely talk about that and the way economics affects your outlook and the way your perspective is shaped by that. But also, I think talking about sex, if you would ask Ike or Buddy Lee, were they homophobic? They would say no in their estimation. I'm not saying that, but they would think that because they've never beaten up a gay man or woman. They don't go out riding to look to cause trouble in the gay community. And so they would think they're not, but they are. And that comes from a narrow-minded view, a misunderstanding of sexuality and what it is and what it means. You know, I think both of the characters speak about trying to punish the gay out of their sons when, you know, that's not possible. You know, you are who you are. And I think I tried to work that in several different ways. One thing that I did was that I always tried to have a character from the LGBT community confront Ike and Buddy Lee about their biases, mm-hmm. about their prejudices. I tried not to let them get off easy when they had confrontations with folks from that community, because for me, it was important to force them to confront their prejudice. I think that's important in any fiction with any character, is forcing them to look at the things that are ugly about themselves and attempt to change them.
Yeah, hold those characters accountable. Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of humor in your novel, which provides a nice break from all the violence and tension. Is that why the humor is there? Is it kind of to serve as comic relief?
A little bit. I think, speaking of Walter Mosley, he has a great quote. I went to a lecture he did back in 2015, and he said that, you know, if you're writing a detective story or a crime story, your detective can't always be detecting. He has to be doing other things. And if you're writing a revenge story, your two characters can't be always, you know, knocking heads and busting out teeth. You know, there's got to be some time downtime. And I think that helps make the story more realistic and more relatable. There is a certain type of book that you can buy where it's just 100% action, all 200 pages. When I was a kid, I used to read the Mac Boleyn series or the Remo Williams, the Destroyer series. And those books are just, you know, it's pure escapist fun where it's action all the time. But in real life, you know, and I think you see this in mob movies a lot, even tough guys have to eat dinner. Even tough guys, you know, have to go to the bathroom or sleep. And so in this book, even these two horsemen of the apocalypse, they have to talk, because when you live in the country, it takes a long time to get anywhere. I use that geographic convention to force them to have conversations. And a lot of times those conversations are humorous, because I think humor is a way that we can communicate with people that maybe we're not comfortable with. And I think it's a unifying principle. And I try to use that with Ike and Buddy Lee. I like to say that Buddy Lee gets all the good one-liners, but Ike gets all the best threats.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. Yeah, you worked that out very nicely. As you said, you were and still are a voracious reader. Would it be fair to say that reading saved your life?
Oh, man. Reading, yeah, it definitely saved my sanity. You know, I grew up in pretty severe poverty. You know, my mother and father separated when I was 2. But as per a lot of situations in a small town, my dad didn't really go that far. I like to tell people my early years were a bad country song, because my mom and dad split up right after our house burned down. And then my mom had some physical ailments that necessitated her using a cane and eventually a wheelchair. And we had to move in with my grandparents. And they lived in an old farmhouse that didn't have indoor plumbing. So I didn't have running water till I was 16. I grew up, people like to tell me when they see me, they're like, God, you're a big dude. I'm like, yeah, because I grew up chopping wood. Until I was like 17 or 18. Yeah. There's no physical training program like chopping a cord of wood for the winter. But I think even in that poverty, even those in those harsh circumstances, reading was an outlet for all of us. My mom, my grandmother, my uncle who lived with us, they were all big readers. My aunt used to give me her Stephen King novels when I was like 9 or 10. I had no business reading them, but I was surrounded by people who really enjoyed reading and saw reading as a way to educate yourself. You know, you can be poor and live in poverty, but you don't have to be poor of spirit or poor of mind, you know? And so, yeah, reading was a way for me to kind of break away from those times when, you know, maybe we didn't have enough food to go around, or maybe, you know, my mom had to make a choice between paying the electric bill and getting my teeth fixed. And so, you know, those hard choices, reading helped lessen the blow on that. Sometimes I could escape to Narnia or Salem's Lot or hang out with the Hardy Boys or what have you. And so reading has always been a very important part of my life.
Oh, and I have to congratulate you on Jerry Bruckheimer and his production team have acquired the film rights to Razor Blade Tears. Are you involved at all? Are you writing the screenplay?
I'm not writing the screenplay, but I have been involved. They've asked me questions about the characters. They've involved me in talking about who's going to write the screenplay. It's going to be written by the great Sherman Payne, who's a great, fantastic screenwriter. Mm. Wrote a movie called Charm City Kings a few years ago. I'll tell you, it's funny.
Right.
I think that was probably the most surreal moment in my writing career, that I am this country fella from a small southern town, a college dropout, and I was on a Zoom meeting talking to Jerry Bruckheimer as he sat in front of his, reflexive concave window that overlooks Malibu, you know, and looking so tan and fresh and the epitome of you know, Southern California, and here I am in my little office that looks like I just moved in, even though we've been here 7 years. It's an incredible surreal moment.
Well, what is your next novel going to be about?
I am working on a book right now, tentatively titled All the Sinners Bleed. And I guess the elevator pitch, it is about a small town in the South. Surprise, surprise. It's about the town's first black sheriff who, on the 1 year anniversary of his election, there's a school shooting. And this school shooting leads him to find out that there has been a trio of serial killers who have been using his small southern town as a dumping ground. And in the school shooting, two of the killers are done away with. But the one is still out there and he's still dangerous and he's angry that his partners have been taken from him. And so this sheriff has to solve this mystery while also dealing with a far right contingent in his town who wants to hold a parade to celebrate the Confederate statue. And he's also dealing with some secrets from his own past, his former time as a FBI agent. So there's a lot of talking about race, class, and sex, and religion, and all the things that make Southern fiction great. Yeah. So, you know, my usual lighthearted fare.
Exactly. You're usually lighthearted, comedic, romantic romps. Sean Cosby, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Razorblade Tears. Thanks a lot.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Sean Cosby writes under the name of S.A. Cosby. He's the author of the novel Razorblade Tears. You can find out more about Sean and his work at wpr.org/beta.
I think the specific social, political, family histories of African Americans, even if racism isn't the monster, can inform the story in a way that will just feel different.
Tanana Reeve Dhu joins us to talk about her reissued novel, The Between, and Black Horror. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Tanana Reeve Dhu is an award-winning author. Her debut novel is called The Between. It tells the haunting story of Hilton James, who survives an accident as a boy, only to wonder if he should have. He spends his days battling the blurring line between fantasy and reality. When Tanana Reeve was working as a journalist for the Miami Herald, she interviewed famed vampire author Anne Rice. Anne shared with Tanana Reeve that the horror genre opens the doors to discussing big themes in ways other fiction can't. So Tanana Reeve wrote The Between for herself. It reflects the black suburban upbringing and fears she had lived with and stands as a pioneering piece in the growing subgenre of black horror. The Between was originally published in 1995 and has recently been reissued. It's a testament to Tanana Reeves' writing style and her vivid imagination that The Between reads like it was just published. She now teaches at UCLA about black horror, which was mainstreamed by Jordan Peele's masterpiece, Get Out. She joins us to talk about her debut and the black horror movement and how she fell in love with horror in the first place.
You know, in some ways I had no choice but to become interested in horror because my late mother, who was a civil rights activist named Patricia Stevens Dew, really, really loved horror. I mean, she loved it. When she was babysitting for our three-year-old back a long time ago, he came home talking about demons. And I was like, what in the world are you talking about? And then I realized, oh, grandma. Because she had been watching, like, age-inappropriate television in front of my son. But that was sort of my childhood. You know, I grew up watching those creature features, those old Universal horror movies. She loved them. I loved them. She gave me my first Stephen King novel at the age of 16, and that really clutched it in terms of my love for horror. But yeah, I think we loved it for slightly different reasons. I think she loved horror as a way to leech away trauma, racial trauma, state violence. She had been subjected to tear gas as an activist, as a very young woman, and wore dark glasses the whole time I knew her. Up until she died, she wore dark glasses 80% of the time, even indoors, because her eyes were sensitive to light. And I never had the chance to discuss this with her. But I think her love of horror stemmed from that, because the monsters in her world were very real, visceral monsters. And I was raised more gently than that. I've never been subjected to violence in my life. So it was a different, as a kid for me, it was like a roller coaster ride. It's only now as I get older that I can see how horror helps me feel better prepared for hardship and tragedy and process. The biggest horror of my life was the loss of my mother.
Yeah. I'm so sorry to hear about your mother, all the trauma she went through.
Oh, thank you.
How did you come up with the idea for The Between?
Well, I'd been writing a bunch of short stories, trying to hone my craft the way I still teach students, you know, start short, publish a few times, you know, use those publications to build up your name, find representation. The problem was I hadn't really published anything. And the one story I sold, the magazine went out of business before they could publish it. So I very much considered myself a newbie writer, an unpublished writer. Then Hurricane Andrew happened in 1992. And I got an idea. Because, and for context, Hurricane Andrew was a wind storm primarily, so it just knocked everything down. So for mile after mile after mile, my hometown of Miami, where I grew up, was almost unrecognizable, especially where my parents lived, where my grandmother lived, my aunt lived. It was the most horrific experience. So that was sort of the idea of the alternate reality. What if you wake up in a world that's very different from the one you went to sleep in? And I embraced a black protagonist because I had started writing, you know, white male characters primarily. And so The Between was, let me write what you know, like what people say. And it was a black family in the suburbs. I had never read that book before. And it was like, and I wrote my sister a letter saying, do you think there would be a market for a black horror novel? I was very tentative, but the story felt so alive in my imagination that I gave myself an artificial deadline, which was a screenwriting contest. Oddly, it's not a screenplay, but they were accepting novels. And I just randomly said, okay, that'll be my deadline. I was working for the Miami Herald at the time. I would get up early and write. I would stay up late writing, sometimes scaring myself because, you know, the book has a lot of nightmares and dream sequences, and it's very preoccupied with death, as was I. So, you know, I was scaring myself. But that was the idea, just this, the idea that of waking up between different realities. And also, obviously, there must have been some sort of way I wanted to address an African-American experience in the story, not just because the characters were black, but because the antagonist is taking the form of a white supremacist. And even though I don't think it was entirely conscious, there must have been, I think, something about the state of being in alternate realities that spoke to a black American experience in my mind.
Yeah, and I think that's why your book is so powerful. Your protagonist, Hilton James, is caught between the real world and the dream world. He's a very likable character. especially at the beginning, but you really put him through hell, which kind of changes his character. Was that difficult for you to do?
You know, I always say I wouldn't want to be a character in one of my books.
Yeah, I can see why.
If I woke up and I was a character in one of my books, I would be like, oh no.
Because, yeah, exactly.
Yes, I do put my characters through hell. And is it hard? On one level, I guess it is hard. But on another level, I'm putting them through these hardships so that I can teach myself how to react and stand up in the face of hardship. Now, Hilton doesn't do, you know, everything I would probably ideally do in real life. There's some pretty wild things he does while he's trying to figure out what's going on with him. Is he schizophrenic? I mean, are these dreams real? He's very confused about what's happening. But primarily, Hilton existed so that, you know, when my storms came, and I knew they wouldn't be his storms, they would look different, that I would have some kind of a model in ultimately courage. Mm-hmm. Because Hilton never gives up. And ultimately, he feels triumphant by mm-hmm. the end of the book. And that's what you want. You know, in the face of things you can't change, how do you gain a sense of triumph over death?
Mm-hmm, definitely. You're one of the pioneers of this movement, which applies to fiction, literature, and also to film, this idea of black horror. How do you define black horror?
That is a fantastic question. And I teach a class in black horror at UCLA called The Sunken Place, Racism, Survival, and the Black Horror Aesthetic. And the way I teach it is very broadly, right? So the between is an example of what you might call racism as the monster. That's not technically true. Death is the actual monster, but death is presenting a face of a white supremacist as the monster. But not all black horror has to be, and people know that from, say, a movie like Get Out by Jordan Peele, where racism is also the monster. But that is not all that black horror is, either in my work or Peele's work or any of the other black horror writers out there. Black horror to me is horror that has a black protagonist with agency in the story, someone you would recognize as making decisions, you know, rather than being just a trope, which is what you find in a lot of, say, cinematic horror, where black characters were relegated to these very tropey roles as just the sacrificial Negro, we call it, the spiritual guide, the magical Negro. It's moving beyond tropes to show black characters in their full humanity. And within that, it can be facing racism as the monster, facing the monster within, or any other theme that you would find in traditional horror that does not have black characters. Black horror is anything the black creators can imagine. And I know that's a very broad theme, but the reason it's important is because people like my mother, for example, watching the horror of the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s, you had to empathize with characters who were nothing like you. The white male is the protagonist, and you could feel for him and cry for him and scream for him, but you never saw yourself reflected. So black horror is the way black artists reflect themselves within the horror genre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. As you mentioned, you teach a course at UCLA, and it focuses heavily on Jordan Peele's Get Out. Can you tell us a bit about the class?
Absolutely. You know, I was teaching something called Afrofuturism at UCLA, which is even broad. It's like it's science fiction, fantasy, and horror. And there weren't a lot of examples in cinema for science fiction or horror except short films when I first started. And this was only about 5 years ago, but it was just pre-Black Panther, pre-Get Out. And when I saw the trailer for Get Out and saw the film, I was like, oh, this is a great linchpin to teach a course about the history of black horror. So yes, it is front-loaded with Jordan Peele. And, you know, my students had to read W.E.B. Du Bois, The Comet, which was a short story in 1920. A lot of people didn't even know Du Bois, who's a social activist, journalist, anti-lynching advocate, didn't even know he wrote fiction, right? But he wrote a horror story where the only survivors were a black man and a white woman, which is sort of lending context to how powerful that pairing is in our history. Like, it's the impetus behind the violence and lynching and Birth of a Nation, a black man chasing a white woman through the woods like he's a bear, basically. Mm-hmm. And so much of lynching is around that dynamic of black masculinity as the so-called threat against white women. And so we lead it with Get Out, but it really is looking at a lot of also creators who came before Get Out, who were making black horror, you know, 1940, Son of Ngagi, you know, came out. And in the 1990s, especially, there was a renaissance in black horror with Rusty Cundiff, Tales from the Hood, and Eve's Bayou by Casey Lemons. But a lot of these directors just could not get second chances. So it kind of disappeared for a while. And now, with the advent of Get Out, black horror is a recognized subgenre. I kind of almost chuckle when I hear people say the phrase, because it's so new to hear people talking about it, even though it has been around for a while.
Yeah. You actually had Jordan Peele attend one of your classes as a surprise guest. How did that go?
Oh, my gosh. Jordan Peele has come to my class probably 3 times.
Oh, really?
Okay. Live, yeah. And the way it all happened was I was just blabbing, as I do on Twitter, about how I was going to be teaching a black horror class at UCLA called The Sunken Place. And a reporter said, "Where's your syllabus?" And I had not even written my syllabus yet. So it was probably like a month and a half later that I was able to give him a syllabus and do an interview. And the day the interview came out, Monkey Paw Productions, which is Jordan Peele's company, followed me on Twitter. And I was already following them. So, you know, the way it works on Twitter is if you're mutual followers, you can send private messages.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just at the age where I'm like, what the heck? I was like, let me just send a message and say, wow, it would really be great if Jordan Peele could come talk to my class. I had to do it. Just had to. Mm-hmm. But then within 2 hours, I was hearing from Jordan Peele himself saying, ha ha, I could surprise them. And I think it was like 2 weeks later, we set it up so that I distracted my students showing a clip from Get Out. For people who've seen it, it's the scene where Rose is shaking the car keys.
Where are those keys, Rose?
You know I can't give you the keys, right, babe?
And my class was captivated, talking to the screen, mad. We snuck Jordan Peele into the very back row. And then as we had rehearsed, or at least discussed, I'll say we discussed it, it's kind of a little sketch. I'll say I did a little sketch with Jordan Peele. Cool. I turned up the lights and I said, okay, what do you think the director is trying to say about the coveting of black bodies? Jordan Peele raised his hand and stood up and said, I have a question. And then he started walking slowly to the front of the class. And as realization grew, let me tell you, that class went wild.
People.
Yeah, the class has grown. We have more than we did last time.
Excellent. How y'all doing?
Good. Yeah. Yeah.
Coming to school today.
Not because, oh, it's Jordan Peele, he's a celebrity, or I know him from Key and Peele, but because we had done so much preparatory work up to the screening of Get Out that they just had so much respect for him as an artist, that they were completely overwhelmed by his, and he answered questions the entire class, and he's come in twice subsequently when I was teaching in person. Right now I'm virtual, and every single time he came, I learned something new, a different take, more insight. He's just so creative and intelligent. The students love his visits.
Mm-hmm, I'll bet they do. Jordan Peele has said that he really made Get Out for black audiences. So I'm curious, who did you write The Between for?
Well, I was unpublished at the time, so I wrote it for me.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. But you must have, in the back of your mind, or maybe somewhere in the middle of your cerebral cortex, you must have had an ideal reader in mind, didn't you?
You know, I continue to be my avatar in terms of who I'm writing for. Mm-hmm. But once I overcame my own invisibility in my work, like where I was writing short epiphany stories with no genre and no blackness, you know, that was how I was trying to become a writer. That's what a writer mm-hmm. looked and felt like in the books I was reading. Once I realized I had the freedom to just write myself and write what I wanted to write, I didn't wrestle with that question anymore about who my audience was. I mean, ever since that point, my characters of my main protagonists are Black. Yes, I do have white characters in all of my books, but my main protagonists are Black. And I'm writing, yes, for Black readers primarily, even though some of them may not like horror. I know when I first came out in the 90s, a lot of people were telling me I don't usually read horror, but that kind of thing. But ultimately, though, of course you want your books to have universal appeal. I'm a big believer in finding the universal through the specific. Mm. I think the specific social, political, family histories of African Americans, even if racism isn't the monster, can inform the story in a way that will just feel different. So a horror reader who's read like a whole bunch of traditional Eurocentric horror can pick up a Black horror novel and find a new way to be scared, which I think is ultimately what horror readers really like. They want to be scared.
Yeah.
They want novelty. And by very definition, you can't be scared by that which you've experienced 100 times already the same way.
Very well said. Tanana Reeve-Dhu, thank you for joining us. It was such a pleasure and honor to talk to you.
Great to talk to you. Thank you very much for those questions.
Tanana Reeve-Dhu is the author of The Between and many other novels and short stories. You can find out more about Tanana Reeve and her work at wpr.org/beta.
He was invited to go over and make a film, which he did in 1970. He made Watermelon Man, which is about a white guy who one day wakes up and realizes he's Black.
Author Ian Hayden Smith joins us to talk about Melvin Van Peebles and Gordon Parks in another edition of Cult Filmmakers. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm the dude.
These guys are 11.
This is a tasty burger.
Inconceivable!
Just a flesh wound.
All right, all right, all right.
As that richly textured audio logo tells us, it's time for another installment of Cult Filmmakers, featuring Ian Hayden Smith, the author of Cult Filmmakers, 50 Movie Mavericks You Need to Know. Today, we have a double feature. We look at the work of Gordon Parks and Melvin Van Peebles. As Ian notes, both were pioneering Black directors who inspired so many future filmmakers like Spike Lee and John Singleton with their impressive talents.
Gordon Parks is one of 20th century photography's greats. I mean, this is a guy who was signed up to the Farm Security Administration in the 1930s. This is the organization that wanted to document the truly damaging impact, not just of the Depression, but also the dust storms that plagued a lot of rural America in the early 1930s. And along with other great photographers such as Walker Evans and the wonderful Dorothea Lange, Gordon Parks went out into this world to document life. But what he focused on was the African-American experience. And give you a very good example of where this balance was in terms of attention. There's a really, really great Dee Reese film that was produced by Netflix a couple of years ago called Mudbound. And it stars Carey Mulligan, amongst other actors. And it's about two families, one white, one Black. Both of them are in a pitiful state in post-war period. This is looking at the 40s and the 50s in America. But as bad as the situation for the white farmers was, it was always so much worse for the African-American farmers. And so what you see with the Farm Security Administration photos of the 1930s, it is pitifully bad for the lives of the people that Walker Evans and Dorothea Lange shot. But the African-American population in rural areas in America arguably even had it much, much, much worse. And Gordon Parks' photos, he never loses a sense of humanity. There's a formal beauty to his work. And he really is a truly extraordinary photographer. But it's the emotion and the level of empathy that he brings to his subjects that makes him a true great. And he didn't stop there. I mean, you know, the war came and he captured life in other parts of America. He became a very, very good friend of Muhammad Ali. And there's a really great German publisher called Steidl. You go online, Steidl. And over the course of the last decade, they've been publishing all of the photographs of Gordon Parks over the course of his career. And there are separate volumes on Muhammad Ali. There's a separate volume on his collaboration with Ralph Ellison, the author of Invisible Man. There's a huge five-volume set of his works. And they just show what an absolute genius of a photographer he was. But then, being a classic Renaissance man, someone who was not happy in one form, he decided to look back on his own life and wrote a novel in 1963 called The Learning Tree, semi-autobiographical account of his life, which then, 6 years later in 1969, he turned into a film. Not just a film, but he was the first African-American to be commissioned by a major Hollywood studio to make a film. It's a really, really major achievement.
Hey, boys! You boys, come here! You boys want to make some money?
What do we got to do?
Simple, ain't nothing to it. You be 7 of y'all fighting in the ring for $10 a day. The last two standing keep swinging to the ultimate fall. The winner gets $4 and the loser gets $1.
What happens to the other five?
Smart boy, ain't you?
Yeah, who gets the rest?
Old Spike is the promoter. Every fight's got to have a promoter. I got to pay for the ring. I got to pay for the winner and loser. I got to pay for everything.
And then 2 years after that, probably the thing that these days he's best known for, he directed Shaft. And that was one of the two films that really launched the blaxploitation genre, as it's now known, which were films that placed front and center black characters, not always positive representations of black characters, but certainly trying, as Oscar Micheaux had done many years before, trying to offer a different representation of African-American life.
I thought you might know something I want to know. Seems there have been a lot of low, quiet rumbles going on uptown. Our people have been able to pick up the sounds of it, but no words.
That's because us black folk talk mush mouth, Lieutenant.
I thought we were going to get to it.
We did, but you want me to pigeon. I just said, up yours, baby.
How come a couple of cats from Harlem come downtown this morning looking for John Shaft?
Well, they're soul brothers. They came down so I could teach them to handshake.
Probably today, it occasionally looks a little bit creaky as a piece of filmmaking. But I think the reason it has lasted is really Isaac Hayes' score and the theme song. That, I mean, it's just stunning. I would argue that if you're going to look at Gordon Parks as a filmmaker, I think The Learning Tree is definitely worth looking at. He made a film about the blues singer Lead Belly in 1976 called Lead Belly. And I think they're really, really great films. And also, I think to look at Gordon Parks at this moment in time in the 1970s, and particularly in terms of, and I know it's now a problematic genre title, blaxploitation, you've also got to look at Melvin Van Peebles. Again, this is another great Renaissance man of African-American culture. Writer, musician, as Gordon Parks also was. He was the classic flaneur. He would travel here, then everywhere. He was inspired by the New Wave because he went over and lived in Paris for a while. And it was while he was there that he wrote a play, which then became his first film, The Story of a Three-Day Pass.
Uncle Tom? Yeah, you. You are the captain's new good colored boy. You are the captain's Uncle Tom, baby.
I'm not the captain's Uncle Tom. Maybe yes, maybe no.
That got the attention of Hollywood, even though he couldn't get Hollywood's attention when he was actually based in Hollywood. He was invited to go over and make a film, which he did in 1970. He made Watermelon Man, which is about a white guy who one day wakes up and realizes he's black.
It's a nightmare. That's what it is, old buddy. Nightmare. Must have been something you eat. That's right, something you ate. Put up your hands. Give me a high school ring. A nightmare. Or too much sun lamp. Boy, what a great sun lamp.
And realizes the inequalities of society through that experience. But it was in 1971 when he directed Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song that he really, really became incredibly well known.
Where's Sweetback? Where is he?
Where's Sweetback?
I don't know where's Sweetback.
Where's Sweetback?
Come on, boy!
I don't want to get qualitative between the two, but I think the important, if we're looking at the importance of both films, in popular culture, Shaft is incredibly important. But I think politically, The thing about Sweet Sweetback is that it was an entirely independent film. It wasn't financed by Hollywood. There was no compromise whatsoever. It was about a black man rebelling against racism and against white America in the late 60s, early 70s. And it is really full on. It's incredibly uncompromising. It's got an amazing score, once again, by Earth, Wind & Fire. And I think this is an incredibly potent film. I know there have been some discussions more recently over its sexual politics. That's certainly problematic in the film. But I think as a political statement, it is an incredibly powerful film. And Melvin Van Peebles' son, Mario Van Peebles, who would go on himself to become an actor and also a director, probably most famous with New Jack City in the early 1990s. He would actually make a film in 2003 called Badass, in which he plays his father making Sweet Sweetback's Badass song, which is an incredibly entertaining film and is a great accompaniment to the original.
Yeah, how did filmmakers like Gordon Parks and Melvin Van Peebles, how did they influence contemporary filmmakers like Spike Lee, John Singleton, and Jordan Peele?
I think by being the landmark of being these first filmmakers, and obviously I also include in this book Oscar Michaud, and one must never underestimate the importance of this truly incredible filmmaker from the silent era going into the sound era in the 1930s. But I think what these guys did was... I think it's two things. Number one, artistically, and perhaps mixed up with politically, they set a standard. They said, look, a black director can work at making a film that reaches out to people. That's really important. But I think it was the moment that Hollywood woke up and realised that there was a very, very... or mainstream cinema woke up and realised there was a very large audience, the African-American audience, that they had not been making films for. And what I find really interesting is that you have this era of films by black directors featuring a great group of black actors, a great ensemble of black actors. And then it's sort of going quiet again in the late 70s into the early 80s. And obviously you have actors, comedians like Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy coming to the fore. But they're working predominantly, not entirely, but predominantly within the strictures of white dominant Hollywood. And it's not until you get She's Gotta Have It, Spike Lee's first film in the mid-1980s, followed by School Days, and then the absolute firestorm, the genius that is Do the Right Thing in 1989, followed shortly afterwards by John Singleton with Boys in the Hood, that you suddenly see a shift. And Spike Lee, perhaps before BlacKkKlansman, I might have included as a cult filmmaker. But I think Spike Lee's always kind of dipped his toes into mainstream cinema with films like Inside Man. But the last few years, he's films like Chirac, which is an extraordinary piece of filmmaking. He's really pushed the boundaries of what he can do. But thankfully, and I'm really happy that he's now back at the centre of attention, making films that people should see, because if they're never always perfect, they are incredibly engrossing and always provocative. And I think that's probably something that's missing too much from cinemas these days, is a sense of provocation, is a sense of being challenged, if not intellectually, then politically, is finding a way to shake us and make us think anew at things. And I think there's a whole group of female horror filmmakers are doing that. I think there are a new generation of filmmakers, upcoming filmmakers, that are doing that. I think Barry Jenkins did that incredibly eloquently with Moonlight. And I think there are directors out there that are doing that. But it's kind of interesting. I think what I love about Oscar Michaud and Gordon Parks and Melvin Van Peebles, very different directors who do not need to be grouped together, but they represent directors who are trying to push for a different kind of filmmaking and a different kind of representation, a very positive representation. And what I think with this book, Cult Filmmakers, if I were to return to it in 15 years' time, I think what I would see is an extraordinarily more diverse group of filmmakers being included. And I've tried as hard as I can in terms of gender and in terms of race to include so many other people. What I think will be really amazing over the course of the next decade or two is that net is going to get wider, and we're going to see so many more interesting directors from so many different backgrounds coming out, working in cult cinema, but hopefully also working at the heart of mainstream cinema.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Ian Hayden Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Ian Hayden Smith talking about Gordon Parks and Melvin Van Peebles. Ian's the author of Cult Filmmakers, 50 Movie Mavericks You Need to Know. Join us for more Cult Filmmakers in the weeks to come. And find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Sean Cosby, Tanana Reeve Du, and Ian Hayden Smith. If you want to hear it again or catch up on past episodes that make long drives and housework more bearable, Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Just search for WPR and Beta. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Take crap off of it. You'll give me some more crap.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
You laid all that jive on me in my office.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I get $50 an hour, plus expenses.